Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. Our program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Every day, we bring you news and information about America and the world. This is what you will hear on our program. We have stories from Kelly Jean Kelly, and also from Alice Bryant and Phil Dierking. But first, we have this story from Dorothy Gundy.
Officials in South Korea are concerned about what will happen to Pyeongchang Winter Olympic structures and stadiums after the games next year. The Winter Olympics begin on February 9, 2018. Officials are busy preparing for events in and around the small mountain town of Pyeongchang. But concerns remain about the huge cost of hosting the games in one of South Korea's poorest areas. Local officials hope the Olympics will help economic development by making the area as an international destination for travelers. But past Olympics have shown that hosts who hoped for economic gains after the games are often disappointed. Pyeongchang is in Gangwon Province. So is nearby Gunlin, a seaside city that will host Olympic skating and hockey events. Officials there are urging the national government to provide money to maintain the new arenas that may have little use after the Olympics. So far, the South Korean government has not agreed to such a plan. The Olympics are expected to cost South Korea about $12.9 billion. That amount is more than the $7 to $8 billion that was estimated when Pyeongchang was announced as host in 2011. People who live in Gangwon Province say the government has long ignored the area's needs. They also worry about the event's high cost. What good will a nicely managed global event really do for residents when we are struggling so much to make ends meet? Said Lee To-sung, a Gangwon restaurant owner. What will the games even leave? Maybe only debt. The mood was very different 30 years ago when the country was preparing to host the 1988 Seoul Summer Olympic Games. That event helped shape the capital city into what it is today. A sports complex and huge public parks were built along the Han River. Next came new highways, bridges, and public transportation. High-rise buildings were built where old, poor neighborhoods once stood. The effects of the country's second Olympic Games will be less clear. For example, Pyeongchang's Olympic Stadium seats 35,000 people, although just 40,000 people live in the town. The stadium will only be used for the opening and closing ceremonies of the Olympics and Paralympics. Then, workers are expected to tear it down. A downhill ski course in nearby Chunsan will also be restored to its natural state and no longer used for skiing. The course was built in a huge forest considered sacred by local people. Kunwan officials want the national government to help pay for restoring the forest. Such efforts could cost as much as $95 million. Both the 1988 Seoul Olympics and the 2002 FIFA World Cup were events paid for by the national government. The provincial government, however, led the effort to host the 2018 Winter Olympics. Under current plans, Kunwan will manage at least 6 Olympic sites after the Games. The costs to do so will be high. These sites will create an $8.5 million budget deficit for the area every year. Hong Chi-won is a Kunlun resident and activist. He has been following Olympic preparations for several years. He said the real cost could be even bigger. And he said aid to help the area's poor could get cut to help make up for the lack of money. South Korea is a rapidly aging country with a widening rich-poor gap. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development says South Korea has the highest poverty rate among the aged of all OECD countries. Pak Shul-shin is an official in Kunwan. He said the national government must step up because, in his words, the Olympics are a national event, not a Kunwan event. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
France recently launched its first floating wind turbine. The new turbine is called Floatgen. It is near the country's western coast. Makers of the turbine say it is able to provide electricity for as many as 5,000 homes. It also is France's first attempt at offshore wind energy. Electricity produced by turbines located in the ocean. The project cost $29.5 million. A number of European businesses and research groups are supporting the Floatgen project. Bruno Gescher is head of sales and a marketing manager for Ideol, the company that coordinated the project. He said the next step is to produce offshore wind farms. The goal, he said, is 50 much larger offshore turbines that are able to provide electricity to hundreds and thousands of people. Gescher predicts that this might happen in less than 10 years because France is trying to decrease the country's dependence on nuclear power. Based in Brussels, Belgium, the industry group Wind Europe predicts France will become Europe's second biggest wind energy producer by 2030. Germany would remain the largest producer. Currently, wind power produces about 4% of France's electricity. Pierre Tardieu is Wind Europe's chief policy officer. He said that renewable energy, such as wind, is not only good for the planet. Today, it is much less costly than it used to be. This is true for France, of course, but it is also true for Europe as a whole, he said.
Increasing wind energy also fits with President Emmanuel Macron's aim of helping lead efforts to limit the rise of world temperatures. Last Tuesday, Macron's government held an international meeting on climate financing. The meeting took place 2 years after the Paris Agreement on climate change was signed in the French capital. Many European Union, or EU, countries say they will likely meet the EU goal of getting 20% of their energy from renewable sources by 2020. They may also increase their renewable energy goals for 2030. But such goals remain hard to reach. France, for example, is one of several EU members not expected to reach the 2020 goals. In addition, French Environment Minister Nicolas Hulot, in November, delayed a 2023 deadline for reducing the nation's dependence on nuclear power. Currently, nuclear energy provides 75% of France's electricity. The 2023 goal was to decrease that number to 50%. Hulot said the deadline could not be met. Germany is a strong producer of renewable energy, but it also depends on fossil fuel. The country gets 40% of its energy from coal, while wind and solar provide 30%. The greater dependence on coal is partly the result of Germany's reduction of nuclear power, which still provides 30% of the country's electricity. With FloatGen, France hopes to go from being one of the EU's slow movers to a wind power leader. I think that the French government understands that it's not possible in the world today to continue just with nuclear power, said Green Party Senator Ronan Dantec. He said nuclear power is very expensive. Having a plan for renewable energy, he added, is important for industry in France and for the country's future electricity needs.
Today, France is one of a few countries testing the use of floating wind turbines. The technology uses wires attached to the ocean floor and can be deployed in deeper waters than non-floating offshore turbines. This helps to make use of deep ocean winds, which are often stronger and more continuous than winds on the coast. Other countries are also moving forward with floating offshore turbines. In October, Britain launched the world's first floating wind farm off of the coast of Scotland. The farm can provide electricity for up to 20,000 homes. "We're late, let's be honest," said France's junior environment minister, Sébastien Lecornu, during FloatGen's launch in Saint-Nazaire. Yet France is seeking to catch up. "We have everything it takes to make this region big in terms of building wind turbines, both on land and offshore," said Regional Council Vice President Paul Genetot. He notes that the FloatGen turbine alone created 70 jobs. "Imagine offshore wind farms here," he added. Wind Europe's Tardieu agrees, predicting Europe's wind industry will generate more than 500,000 jobs by 2030, more than double today's numbers. "Blades can be produced in Portugal and turbine structures in Poland," he said. "Belgium can make the equipment boxes."
But the FloatGen project is not welcomed by everyone. A few meters from the launch celebrations, riot police faced protesting workers. "We face an uncertain future," said Mathieu Pinot, a member of a trade union, as he spoke with other protesters. A fuel and coal heating plant has employed him for many years. Now, the company is slowly closing down. He said renewable energy does not offer long-term jobs, but rather unstable part-time work. But renewable energy supporters disagree. Wind energy today already represents thousands of jobs, said EDEAL marketing manager Gesher. It could represent much more than that, local jobs, but also brain power. I'm Phil Dierking.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about William Jefferson Clinton, better known as Bill Clinton. Clinton took office in 1993 and was re-elected in 1996. In many ways, historians consider his time in office a success. The economy expanded, and the country was largely at peace. But Clinton had some notable failures, too. He could not persuade Congress to accept a plan to reform the nation's health care system. And, in his second term, the House of Representatives took steps to remove him from office. But the Senate decided not to act. Clinton finished his second term with high approval ratings. Yet, he is also remembered for being only the second U.S. president to be impeached. Bill Clinton came from a town with a memorable name, Hope. He grew up there and in another nearby town in the southern state of Arkansas. For most of his early life, Bill was raised by his grandmother and his mother, both nurses. His father had died in a car accident before he was born. People who knew Bill as a young man remember him as very intelligent, charming with people, and talented in music. His mother told him he would be president one day. Sure enough, Clinton pursued activities that would lead to a political career. He attended college at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., where he studied international affairs, led student government groups, and took a position as a clerk in the U.S. Senate. He went on to study at Oxford University in England on a prestigious Rhodes Scholarship. Then he graduated from law school at Yale University. There, he met another student who would be his wife, Hillary Rodham. The two went on to have one child together, a daughter named Chelsea. After finishing his studies, Clinton returned to his home state of Arkansas and pursued political office. At 32, he became one of the youngest governors ever in the country. 2 years later, he was voted out of office and, as historian Russell Riley notes, he became the youngest former governor. And that is how a good deal of Clinton's political career continued, in a pattern of successes and failures. His successes often came as a result of his centrist policies, which appealed to people of different political beliefs. He also was an effective public speaker and, to many, a likable, charismatic person who seemed to care deeply about others. But, his critics pointed out, Clinton also appeared to make many decisions simply for political advantage. And he sometimes tried to please so many people that he pleased no one. Following a series of increasingly national roles, as well as a series of setbacks, Clinton campaigned for president in 1992. At first, he did not do well in the campaign. He was young and not well known. He also suffered from reports that he had relationships with women who were not his wife. But in time, Clinton began winning primary contests. Reporters called him the comeback kid. He earned a public image as a politician who could survive problems. In the general election, Clinton competed against the sitting president, Republican George H.W. Bush. The two men also faced an unusually strong third-party candidate named Ross Perot. On election night, Clinton prevailed. Because Americans had split their votes among three major candidates, Clinton earned less than 50% of the popular vote. But he won enough electoral votes to become the next U.S. president. The people who worked on Bill Clinton's presidential campaign adopted an informal motto. They said, "It's the economy, stupid." In other words, campaign officials believed that most Americans cared primarily about how a president's policies would affect their financial concerns. So, President Clinton quickly set about making a series of economic changes. They included raising taxes on wealthier Americans and cutting spending to help poorer Americans. In a few years, the U.S. budget deficit was gone, the federal government had a surplus, and the country's financial situation was strong and healthy, although not everyone approved of the steps Clinton took to get there or believed he should get all the credit. Early in his first term, Clinton sought an additional reform he believed would help voters' financial concerns: affordable health insurance for all Americans. Most people in the U.S. either bought private health insurance or did not have any insurance to help pay for medical costs. Clinton wanted to find a way for the U.S. government to support Americans' health-related expenses. He appointed his wife, First Lady Hillary Clinton, to lead a health care reform effort. Hillary Clinton, a lawyer, had led a similar effort to reform education in Arkansas when her husband was governor there. But some lawmakers in Congress, as well as some voters, rejected her efforts. The reform effort failed. Clinton also struggled in some early foreign policy moves. He withdrew American troops from Somalia after their humanitarian efforts there turned into a bloody military struggle. He was also criticized for failing to intervene quickly in the genocide in Rwanda, where hundreds of thousands of people were killed. Later, Clinton won praise for some of his foreign policy. His government helped restore the elected president in Haiti after a coup. It also helped negotiate peace agreements in Bosnia and Ireland. And it cooperated with NATO to intervene in the Kosovo area and stop attacks on Albanians there. In general, Clinton believed the U.S. had an important role to play in maintaining peace and protecting human life around the world. At the same time, he did not want to use too many American resources to do so. He aimed to cooperate with other nations and to set moderate goals. As usual, Clinton adopted an approach that was not too extreme on one side or another. During most of his time as president, Clinton had been under investigation. Federal judges had appointed a special counsel named Kenneth Starr, to find out if the president had committed any crimes related to financial investments before he took office. During the investigation, Starr learned that the president had been having a sexual relationship with a young woman who worked in the White House. Starr asked Clinton about the affair under oath. Later, Starr accused Clinton of lying about his relationship with the woman. Starr said that Clinton had also tried to prevent others from telling the truth about some of his activities. In time, the president publicly admitted the relationship, and he apologized to voters and his family. But he said he had not lied or told anyone else to lie for him. Lawmakers in the House of Representatives did not accept Clinton's defense. They advanced two articles of impeachment. Lawmakers in the U.S. Senate then considered the case. It is their job to examine the evidence and decide whether to remove a president from office. A majority did not believe the actions Clinton was accused of were serious violations against the country. They voted to acquit Clinton of the charges and permit him to continue as president. In the U.S., a president can serve only two full terms. After his second, Bill Clinton and his wife settled in a town outside New York City. In time, Hillary Clinton became the U.S. Senator from New York, as well as a Secretary of State and the Democratic Party's candidate for president. Bill Clinton, like many other U.S. presidents, wrote about his experiences and helped develop his presidential library. He also worked on humanitarian, health, and economic issues with his family's organization, the Clinton Foundation. For many, Clinton's time in office is remembered as a mixed experience. The economy was at one of its strongest in U.S. history. Most people could find jobs, and many Americans bought homes for the first time. In the mid-1990s especially, the internet and other new developments created a technology boom. In addition, Clinton was an effective public speaker, and he inspired new groups of people to support his Democratic Party. Many voters approved of his appointments of women and minorities to positions of power in his government. They also liked the steps he took to reduce the use of handguns, protect the environment, and provide paid time off work for some people to care for themselves or their families. But both Democrats and Republicans found fault with some of Clinton's efforts. And even his supporters note that the president had to spend much of his time in office answering charges of wrongdoing. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from America and around the world.